Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sitnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Roger Littwiller. The Ships of the Bay of Quinte was the first book you published, Roger. How did you come to write that one? And what was it that especially appealed to you about that story?
It's the first book that I had published. It's the second book that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
The way it came about is I was researching Trentonian for White Ensign Flying, and I realized it was going to be a fairly large book, and I came to the conclusion that to walk into a publisher with 300 pages in a document and slap it on the table and say, "Hi, I want you to print this, and it's the first thing I've ever written," wasn't going to do so well. So I wrote Warships, which is smaller and a little more general. Fortunately for me, Dundurn Publishing picked it up. With that, they enjoyed my writing, and the book did well. So
that was very fortunate.
Yes.
I know you've told us a little about what makes your books different from many historical books about the Navy, but tell us some more. Yeah, if you had to define what's different about yours from, say, a straight naval history, what would you say?
Well, the history is there, and I kind of came to the realization when I was a sea cadet at the Battle of Atlantic celebrations. We're with the veterans, and we're listening to the stories, and they're talking to each other, and we're, you know, the reception afterwards. We're with the vets, and listening to their conversations, I realized they're talking about Normandy, but what they're talking about isn't anything that we learned in school. And what they're talking about is a lot more interesting. So I realized if you can tell the story, especially from the people that experienced it, then all of a sudden history comes alive. It's no longer history. It's a story. And, you know, literally to quote, history is his story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And for now, it's her story as well with, you know, the women, men and women that have served in our military. It's getting that story. You know, history books are great. Academics love them. They're great for learning dates, times, facts, and figures. But most people don't want dates, times, facts, and figures.
So you really wanted to write for the general reader, not just the person
Absolutely.
Who is interested in naval history.
Yeah, the dates, times, facts, and figures are all in my books.
Mm-hmm.
They're secondary to the story. So if you read the story, you get all the history, but you're reading a story.
Yeah, and I bet some of them are funny stories.
Some of them are. There's some really unique and interesting. One in particular is, you know, Trentonian was off the Grand Banks coming from Newfoundland to Halifax when the skipper came up and saw that there was a sonar contact and checked with the operator, and the operator said, "Yeah, it's a biological," meaning animal, and he immediately ordered a depth charge dropped.
What?
Yep. Turned the ship around, came back to where they dropped the depth charge, sent the boat's crew off in the whaler, and they brought back a boatload of fish, fresh fish, that they had blown up with this depth charge. And I've got pictures of, you know, all these fish laying on the deck of Trentonian.
Well, I hope they had to eat them.
The guys from the sailors from the Maritime already had their knives sharpened as the boat's crews were out there. They cut and filleted the fish. The cooks had the pots ready, and they had one incredible seafood feast.
Good. So, Roger, you've done a lot of teaching in your time. How has this influenced what you write?
It's allowed me to be comfortable talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm doing presentations or lectures, I enjoy getting up in front of a group and given the opportunity to talk about what I'm writing about.
But you've also done teaching for the cadets, have you not? And
yep.
for the paramedics.
And for paramedics, yep.
Yeah.
It's given me some skills in teaching from 9 years old right up into any age.
Mm-hmm.
And I gear my talk to, you know, of course, the nine-year-olds, the attention span is not quite as long as an adult, but not much longer. So most adults, if you start to run on, they'll start to give you the clearing throat. So
so can you join the cadets at 9?
For the Navy, Lee cadets are from 9 to 12, and the Sea cadets are 12 to 18.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
That must be fun for a 9-year-old to belong to.
It's
like
pretty
that.
Neat. I've mm-hmm. worked with both organizations over the years and really enjoy the entire experience.
Please read us an excerpt from The Ships of the Bay of Quinte then, Roger.
No problem. Warships of the Bay of Quinte is about 6 Canadian Navy ships named for the Quinte communities. During the Second World War, the Canadian Navy was building over 400 ships to meet the demands that were required on the North Atlantic. So the Navy had the money to build the ships. Men were volunteering to crew the ships, but there wasn't money there to make the ships comfortable. You know, because a ship is a home, first off. So they came up with this great idea. Let's name the ships after communities. We'll get the communities to provide all the comforts for the men that live in the ship. And in fact, there was a Cobourg and there was a Port Hope as well during the war. Both successful ships. So Warships of the Bay of Quinte involves Napanee, Corvette, Belleville, Corvette, Trentonian, a Corvette, Hollowell for the Picton area, which was a frigate, and 2 minesweepers, both named Quinte. The first Quinte was in the Second World War and has the dubious distinction of being the only Canadian ship to sink twice in 10 days. And that story's in there. Really quite fascinating. And the second Quinte was after the Second World War and actually took part in the Cuban Missile Crisis with the rest of the East Coast Fleet. So the service of these ships are really quite unique. So this passage is with Napanee, and she was built very early in the Second World War. She was one of the first corvettes to be commissioned. So her service runs almost the entire length of the war.
And are you going to tell us about the supplying of the ship in this excerpt?
No. This is actually one of the convoy battles that she was involved in.
But just before you begin, then, what kinds of things did the citizens of Napanee provide for the ship?
Well, actually, Napanee provided the ship's bell, and that is on display at the museum in Napanee. But for the most part, most communities provided all the comforts, so bedding, ashtrays, magazines, pictures on the walls, washing machines, hot plates, toasters, all the little things that sailors need to live at sea in their ship.
And then the Navy provided the sort of edibles and
all that sort of thing. The communities were not unknown to send care packages of, you know, chocolate and cakes and cigarettes and even some libations and the liquid type. You know, all manner of comforts were sent by the communities, and open gifts and letter writing kits and ditty bags and jackets and patches. And
I think that's a wonderful story about how the communities came together to support their.
It got to the point where communities aggressively petitioned the Canadian Navy to have a ship named after them. Uh-huh. It was a true honor.
Don't let me interrupt you.
Go
ahead and read.
So Napanee was involved in one of the single worst convoy battles during the war. It was a 6-day running battle from the European side of the Atlantic Ocean all the way through to the North American side. It was 6 Canadian escort ships. Napanee was one. And they came up against 24 German submarines over the course of 6 days. 14 merchant ships were lost, 500 sailors killed, another 500 were rescued, and it was the only time that the German U-boats were in a position to take prisoners, and they actually took prisoners of the merchant sailors. So it was a horrific, horrific battle. Mm. So the way it reads, this starts on the 29th. Of December, just after Christmas, and they crossed into the battle zone right on Christmas Day. By the next morning, the 29th, the Admiralty reported 6 enemy submarines were in direct contact with the convoy, and an additional 12 were joining. The Germans would soon outnumber the escorts by a factor of 3 to 1. The convoy was ordered to alter course to the west in the hope of still avoiding the concentration of U-boats, but several submarines were able to gain glimpses of the convoy through the fog and remain in contact. The poor weather and visibility that had protected the convoy for the last day and a half suddenly lifted. As the sky cleared, eight submarines had direct visual contact of the convoy. The U-boats remained on the surface, just outside of the escort's attack range, openly hunting the convoy as a pack of wolves stalks a deer, knowing their prey can no longer escape. Their numbers continued to grow, and just before sunset, 11 submarines were surfaced on both sides of the convoy about 5 miles away. The senior officer of the convoy in Saint Laurent urged HMS Fidelity to launch one of her seaplanes to assist with the evening's course change and drive off some of the U-boats. But as the waves continued to grow, the seaplane crashed on takeoff into a 12-foot wave. Fortunately, Saint Laurent was able to rescue the two men crew. The men of the convoy took to the decks, lifebelts inflated, and fearful of being trapped below decks, knowing that a deadly attack was now inevitable. They did not have to wait long. As the sun set, the sky and the ocean combined into a blackness that the eye could not penetrate. The first attack came at 1941, when U-203 and U-435 each made separate unsuccessful attacks on convoy ONS-154. Just before the moon was to rise, Battleford gained a radar contact and closed to investigate. What she found was astounding. Four U-boats on the surface in line-ahead formation, bearing down on the convoy for attack and using light signals to coordinate themselves as they raced in. Battleford illuminated the attacking U-boats and opened fire with assistance from Chilliwack, successfully breaking up the first concentrated attempt by the submarines to penetrate the convoy. But it cost Battleford her radar as it was knocked out of service by the blast of her own guns. And the convoy battle goes on from there.
Thanks so much, Roger. That was really great. Where can listeners buy your books, and where will you next be talking about them?
Any bookstore can, if they don't have them in stock, can order them in.
Mm-hmm.
Chapters is carrying them in the stores and online. Also on Amazon. You can also order direct from Dundurn Publishing. As far as talking, October 3rd, I'll be in Quinte West for the Doors Open Ontario. November, I will be in Kanata at the Chapter Store in Ottawa. In January, I'll be in Belleville at the Historical Society there.
You're a busy man.
It's fun. I'd like to note, if anybody wants to learn more about this, I do have a Twitter feed at R. Litwiller, and I post a Navy photo from the collection every single day on my Twitter feed.
To connect with us, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs to our email, wordonthehills897@gmail.com, or connect with us at our website, www.wordonthehills.com, where all these programs are archived and available to listeners at any time. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another program next week.